So I'd like to welcome back to our podcast Professor Bruce Arrell, who I think it's fair to say is a friend of the podcast now. This is your second interview with us. Bruce is a professor of general practice at Auckland University. He's also currently the head of department of the primary care department at Auckland University. He's the director of the Goodfellow Unit and a practicing GP, and he's also an honorary fellow of the Royal New Zealand College of Urgent Care. And it's great to have you back on the podcast, Bruce. I got in touch with you because of a conundrum we have in urgent care, which is the mental health consultation. Unlike general practice, where you have a prior relationship and maybe a follow-up option with your patients, we don't have that. We're a little bit more floating in the breeze when it comes to that. We are, though, lucky in that we can extend our consultation a bit longer because we don't have the pressure of booked appointments. So there's a kind of a give and take between general practice and urgent care in managing these things, but there are a lot of similarities. And you've done a lot of work on managing depression in general practice, and I'd be interested to know your thoughts on the consultation that maybe begins on a completely different level, let's to say a middle-aged man who's asked for a male doctor with apparently a sore throat, and then right at the end of that apparent consultation turns to me and says, I'm feeling really low and I've contemplated suicide. That's sort of the bombshell has dropped. How do we assess these people in a fairly expedient way, but safely assessing their risks and everything around that?
Well, I call this the minute 14 out of 15 bombshell, basically, and I think we've all had this sort of situation, and the last thing we want is the waiting room to be sort of backing up and then to have to sort of decompress each patient as they come in. So I would call this situation an acutely distressed patient, and we're assuming they're not going to be asking for antidepressants, because if they ask for antidepressants, you can say, well, there are other things we could do and we could think about antidepressants later. So let's assume the patient's not asking for antidepressants, they're saying what you said. What I would do, one of the quickest things you can do is an emotional quality of life assessment. You can ask the patient, if 100's the best imaginable quality of life and 0 worst, where are they now? And if it's 50 or below, their PHQ-9 score is going to be above 10. So a score below 50 tells you that they have a reduced mood. So therefore, you know there's going to be motivation issues there, and this may take a bit longer. If it's above 50, then they're possibly functioning reasonably well with work and stuff like that. So, and the other thing is, it's just important to be seen, heard and understood for the patient. So the more empathic you can be, and I think it only takes a few minutes. If you're really listening to somebody and hearing what they're saying and let the air out of their tires, or get them to calm down very quickly. So just a little bit of active listening. So not talking first, I think, can be helpful. Even if you're busy and pressured for time, I think trying to just keep your own pulse under 100 is not a bad idea. Depends whether you would know some of the past history, what their are they on current medication. If they are, then you know they've had episodes of distress where someone thought they may need medication, and you might want to ask a little bit about past history. Have they seen a doctor before for emotional issues? And I tend rather use words like depression and anxiety. I prefer emotional issues or distress. They're known as transdiagnostic terms. So, and I guess the key thing that's come out of our research is you can assume they've reduced their life. Basically, life constriction accompanies mental health problems. And you can assume they've reduced their contact with friends, and you can assume they've reduced their recreational activities, and you can assume they're not fit. It's very unusual to see a distressed patient who's physically fit, unless it's their occupation, they're a personal trainer or they work in a gym. So invariably you can assume those three things, and they need to be reversed essentially. So they need to start contacting their friends, they need to start learning how to play again, and they need to start some exercise. So those are the first three things I get people do. And we know if we do nothing at 2 weeks, about 20% of people are better. If we did absolutely nothing but just listened and let them go, we know 42% of people with behavioral activation will be better in 2 weeks. And if we give drugs, it's about 5%, so over and above control.
So that's a treatment as well as a screening question you ask at those three areas of their life. And if they are deficient in those three, that supports a low mood condition. And you encourage them to improve those three aspects.
I have a questionnaire called Work, Love, Play, which takes under 5 minutes. So if you wanted to extend your consultation, you could. It's on www.brucearrell.com. It's free. And it has five questions about work, lovers and friends, lovers and intimates, lovers and family, and play. And they're all on a 1 to 10 scale. And a score below 35, which is very common in people who are distressed, is associated with a PHQ-9 greater than 10. So it saves you doing a PHQ-9, and you get a whole lot of extra information about the patient. So how are you going to spend your 2 minutes? Are you going to watch them fill out a PHQ-9, which isn't particularly helpful, other than to give you a linear score of their distress, versus doing a work, love, play questionnaire, which will give you the context of the patient's life, from which you will always find things that they can change. There's always something there to work on.
So you can get that off your website.
Yep.
And presumably that's then a good follow-up for the general practitioner to repeat. It's a quantifiable kind of improvement or worsening score. But as you say, it's a bit more active in that we're doing it and finding useful information that we can then target some advices for that maybe prevent us from reaching for the prescription pad.
That's right. My advice is to keep the antidepressant gun in the holster, basically. It's hard in these situations, but antidepressants are very slow onset. You know, as I say, in 2 weeks' time, maybe there'll be a 5% gain over placebo. If you get people back into the river of life, 42%, I mean, what would you do? It doesn't make any sense to give a drug in these situations, whereas you can give behavioral activation. In terms of labels, if you need an official label in med tech, you can use adjustment reaction. It's not a DSM-4 diagnosis anymore, but it's just a fudgy transdiagnostic term that may satisfy billing purposes if you have to do it for billing. It can get somebody a sickness benefit. I've been able to do that. But just remember, you're often seeing people on the worst day of their lives. This chap who's come to see you is probably in the worst day of his lives, and we wouldn't want to give him a big label or a big drug that may affect his employment in future, his insurance in future. He might overdose on our medication. You know, there's a whole lot of things that could happen. So the behavioral activation is really important. So contacting your friends, doing recreation, and getting fit are what's called behavioral activation. And I always get people to score on the 1 to 10 scale. So you say to somebody, if 10 means you'll absolutely do it and 1 means no chance at all, where are you now? And they've got to give you a 7 or more out of 10. Otherwise, I say to my doctor colleagues, you're on cuckoo land, doctor, because you haven't checked out whether the patient really wants to do it. If they say 2 out of 10, their subconscious is giving you a big message. You know, consider something else. And it can be a bit of a surprise to patients and yourself when they say 2 out of 10. Think, well, I wasn't expecting that. And yet 10 years ago, I would have happily accepted, you know, somebody was going to go to the gym every day. And then I wonder a week later why they didn't do it. Well, I never checked it out.
I'd be interested in your thoughts on follow-up, because follow-up is available to you as a general practitioner. You can insist on it and plan it around yourself, but we don't have that luxury. And we try to engage with the patient enough that they will hopefully follow up with their own registered GP or some other kind of psychology service, perhaps. How would you, what approaches do you have to the consultation, maybe from the safety netting point of view, and the ensuring follow-up with the general practitioner?
Well, from the safety net point of view, most people will have had some suicidal thoughts, so you would normalise that its plans to commit suicide, I think, are more. And that's fairly uncommon in primary care, to have somebody who's actually planning a suicide attempt. So then you have to go down the red flag, ask about all the different methods they might use, and do almost like a formal assessment. So the climate changes rather considerably, and you're going to sort of be more in interrogation mode than empathic mode. People like Russ Harris, the ACT GP in Australia, talks about saying to people, there's part of you that doesn't want to kill yourself, and that's the bit I'd like to work with, which actually is a nice sort of positive way of saying, well, how can we work together to get you going again? Obviously, if somebody says, well, you know, I don't want to get going, well, then you might have a bit of a problem. But most people respond to that, I would say. You have to sometimes say to people, well, how do we keep you safe for now until we can see you again? I think I try and see people within the week. If they're very, very flat, I try and see them within a few days, and that may be possible in your setting. Alerting the GP to leave a message at the GP's office and say this person needs to contact you. So if they don't turn up, the GP knows about it. But I'd make it a attention to GP, urgent attention. Another thing that's probably very helpful actually is a phone call to the patient. A, it satisfies your curiosity, and the patient will think you're the most terrific doctor on earth if you phone them up. And I don't know how much time you folks have, but that's a big home run. And usually people are a whole lot better. The natural history of acute distress is for most people to get better. And if they're not, well, then you might want to have a discussion about medication, but that's 2 or 3, 4 weeks down the road. And I call it my talk first, prescribe later, label rarely. So we don't want to give people labels. Labels are only useful if there are more benefit than harm to patients. And a lot of the labels we give patients in the mental health domain can be potentially wrong and harmful. So I think we have to be cognizant of that.
And you mentioned normalizing things like suicide or thoughts. Do you try and normalize mental health problems in general with the patient and say that it's a very common thing? This is not.
Well, I often say to patients, when I get distressed, there's a particular mindfulness MP3 I listen to, you know, and I listen to Sharon Salzberg for about 5 minutes and I feel better. I also talk about the dashboard light. So I talk about my life dashboard light. When I don't want to go to the gym, it means I'm under sufficient stress that I need to go to the gym. So we all have to recognize what our life dashboard light is. And it'll be different things for different people, stopping cooking meals for themselves, stopping socializing, those sort of things. So we all have to recognize those things. So I quite freely disclose those things. I don't go into my own sort of problems with the patient. I think that's inappropriate. But just to show the patient you're a human being who suffers as well, I think is completely fine. And most GPs, most doctors do that to a certain extent. Anyway, we've done some research on that. It's the majority will actually disclose. Sometimes it's just, well, I get eczema, like you. I can understand why you're having trouble. You're wanting to scratch your skin. Makes complete sense. So, yeah, so I think showing the patient that you're a human being who suffers, I think, does sort of balances up the power relationship. You know, you've got enormous power as a health professional. I think things we can do to reduce that power gap are important.
So if you follow this sort of approach where you're maybe looking into some of the deficiencies in somebody's daily life, the things that they've let go, the love,
work-love-play,
and that gives you a framework to explore where this person's kind of issues might be, and it enables you to maybe try and impress upon them the importance of improving whichever one they've been deficient in. And then with regards the follow-up, you've mentioned trying to see them again. That can be through impressing upon them the GP or making that phone call. What about the helplines and other kind of, do you always?
Yep, sometimes I give out the four-digit number, which I'm having trouble remembering at the moment.
But is that something you would recommend as a take-home do patients need the information in their hands more, or do they benefit more from being listened to and talked to in these
I think being listened to and talked to, I often give them a task sheet. So I write a task sheet and I write down number one, number two, number three, the score they've given about likelihood. And then I get them to read it out to me while I'm typing it in the notes. And nobody's ever said I was going to go to the gym every day of the week, 7 out of 10, I'm not going to do that. They're still playing along with the game, if you like. Well, they're still committed to doing what they said they would do. So it does doubly reinforce that. And I guess you could put in there, call the helpline if they wanted to. Depends on how serious you think things are with them, or you can ask to put it into their phone if they want to. There may be ways of doing that. So there's a lot of things. There's a lot of scope for creativity. And I think the other thing is, so like in the urgent care situation, you might be the person that they've unloaded to. They might want to see you again. And I don't think that would be necessarily a bad thing, because you're the port in the storm. And I think I'm very much interested in the what are called the frontline person who sees the patient first, actually being as helpful as they can. And I think, you might have saved that man's life, for example, that you're just describing has come in, and he may feel very bonded to you. You may be the first person who's listened to him. And so I think, and really it's our humanity that I think is what helps pay. And there's quite a bit of evidence about that, that actually you may be technically good, but if you don't have that humanity, you won't heal people. And so it may be appropriate if in some circumstances to get that person back, just to say, look, you can go back and see your GP. You're welcome to come back here if you'd like, and what's your preference, and see how they go. So
so listening is certainly a priority in these consultations, not rushing. You mentioned the press of the waiting room. We've got to maybe park that a little bit. But make sure we've listened and gathered enough information to make us comfortable that this person can be discharged home with some good advices and maybe a plan for them to try and make some improvements. What would be the real red flags for you in mental health consultation that would make you think, no, you're not going home from here, I'm going to be calling the mental health crisis team?
I think if they had any plans to commit suicide, if they were super, super flat. But I mean, I've seen people who've been super, super flat who are completely well in 3 or 4 weeks. So you sort of wonder, it's very, very hard to prospectively figure out what somebody's label is. I think you can give somebody a label retrospectively sometimes, but prospectively, our predictive tools are very poor. If we're assuming urgent care really is a primary care setting, then the positive predictive value is like 200 for a positive feeling about a suicidal thought or feeling. So it's a very low prevalence setting. And so really it would be the person, and it may be a sixth sense sometime. I mean, I just think you have to go on your gut reaction. You might have had a bad experience with the previous patient. Well, that's going to colour. If your previous patient's taken an overdose, then you're probably going to be in danger mode for the next 100 patients. So it's not. I don't think there's any easy answer to that. I think you have to use, that's where clinical experience comes in. But you don't want to spook everybody to death with a formal, you've got to be judicious with that. You don't want to hit everybody with red flags. You're going to lose rapport. Because once you start asking about lethal means of killing people, the climate's changed at that consultation, and it's a different climate.
So how would you address that question? What's the best way to open that door and then move on without dwelling on it?
I'd ask people, if they had suicidal thoughts. I might say, have you had any thoughts of killing yourself? And have you got any plans to kill yourself? So if they said no about thoughts, I mightn't ask about plans. If they said yes, or they were ambivalent about it, they hummed and hard, sort of a maybe, then I would go down the formal suicide route. But that means asking about every potential means possible, which, the whole thing, you've changed the dynamic of the consultation.
But if they've said yes to, I have plans, you're asking the next subsequent questions with a the mindset that you're going to be contacting the psychiatry services. From the point of view, as I mentioned, in general practice, the are discharging to your care.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that we can maybe pick up the phone and arrange mm-hmm. follow-up with you. Is it reasonable for an urgent care physician to refer to a psychology service directly, or do you think it should be something that should be governed and mediated by the general practitioner?
Ideally through the GP, because most GPs, like in Counties Manukau, we have the wellness program where we can see people for extended consultations ourselves and then refer on to our own internal resources. I think if you started referring people to people you thought, unless they had a particular condition and you knew there was a particular person, you know, they've got a particular, you know, internet gambling or something, something unusual, you might, and you knew somebody who specialised in that. But by and large, I'd send them back to their GP for more of the same talk stuff, and then the GP can use their internal resources, their referral systems within their clinic. That's what we do with our clinic. So we would see the people and see how they're going. And most of them are going to be better the next week. That's the key thing. So don't drop a drug on them at the first visit, because they're going to be better the next week, and they're never going to know if they would have got better. 42% of them are going to be better in 2 weeks with mere behavioural activation. Numbers need to treat are 2.5. Numbers need to treat for any drug is at best 4 to 16. So we're a little irrational if we feel like if we don't give the antidepressant, the people might kill themselves. There's also the risk they might kill themselves with our drug. So it's a double-edged sword. You're giving a lethal means to somebody potentially to end their life.
So our priority is to listen, to document some kind of quantifiable number that can be used for follow-up, but also to aid our diagnosis, screen for serious illness, and to encourage some improvements without medicine and arrange follow-up.
Yeah.
What would you recommend if somebody didn't have a GP? If they were a 20-something-year-old male and they don't have a GP, what lengths do we have to go to ensure they register with a GP?
That's a bit tricky. You might want to see the person yourself in that situation. I think that would probably be, there'd be a bit of a risk for that person trying to find a GP. You know, that's another task they would have to do, maybe see them and ensure that actually got better. And I guess if they hadn't, then you might want to phone a GP. I'm sure you've got friendly GPs you could recommend. They could go to a practice.
We should hold on to a little bit more.
Think so. Yeah, because then they're going to have a fee at the first. You know, then that puts a financial barrier. So I think there would be situations where it would be completely appropriate for you to see somebody if they were willing to come back. I mean, you could give them the option, I think. I think it's always worth saying, well, look, one option is to come back and see me. Another option is to go and find a GP. There's a good person, man or woman, down the road who I would recommend you go and see. But, you know, they may wait then 2 weeks to get in. And, you know, then the person's all sort of lost and at sea.
But a phone call follow-up would be reasonable.
I think phone call would be really, really cool, actually. I'd be super impressed if I got a phone call about that sort of stuff, because it just alerts the GP that that you're concerned and this is somebody. I think it's wraparound care. It's really making sure the patients. And then, of course, if they don't turn up, then you've got to, you know what's happened. They haven't turned up.
So if you've done what we've suggested, you've kind of done this, followed this path and made the effort to safety net and arrange follow-up, I guess our biggest fear is that something will happen, you know, that we get a phone call to say that this person has gone and harmed themselves or attempted to harm themselves or worse. How do we ensure that we have done everything possible or is there just going to sometimes be those cases that will slip through because...
Well, I have to say my own experience is something else has happened between when you've seen something that you didn't think would happen and when there's an attempted suicide or a completed suicide. Things have happened in that person's life, and I think you just have to accept you've done your best job, take your own pulse, and just realise this is there's a danger in this work that people may harm themselves, and in your career that's going to happen. but not beat yourself up, so long as you are doing as thorough a job as you can in the time you've got. You haven't got an hour, and so long as you've covered the bases and done your best, I think we have to learn to a bit of self-compassion for ourselves sometimes in these situations. It's terrible when somebody does OD on your watch. It's a situation where doctors do start to beat themselves up big time, so you need to talk to a supportive colleague who can help you get through that phase. There's no one's going to criticise you as much as yourself, will be my experience. And those, when something goes wrong in healthcare, we beat ourselves up much more than the system does. The system's relatively benign, I think, but none of us want that to happen on our watch, do we?
No, and you mentioned mindfulness before, and other measures of self-care, I guess, that we have to remember that we're human too. One final question would be the patient who has come in wanting a medication. We've maybe discussed here ways in which you would avoid, in an urgent care setting, giving a medication. If a patient really wants one, now there are certain drugs that would get our red flags raising when somebody demands a certain medication, but let's say it's a non-sinister one. Let's say they've said, my friend had fluoxetine and felt much better afterwards, and so I want it. Is that sort of patient who's after a drug, are they going to benefit from it because of the desire to have it? Or are we still better off going through this kind of non-medicinal approach?
Well, almost certainly, because the placebo rate is 41%, irrespective of your level of severity. So if they believe it is going to work, it probably will work. When I've looked at my own numbers, it's about 7% of people get an antidepressant at the first visit. And all those cases are people who've come in saying, my sister's on citalopram, I want citalopram, my mother's on it, or I used to be on it, which of course they got better, and it was probably a placebo response. Most responses to antidepressants are placebo, irrespective of level of severity. So, and I like, I guess philosophically, I like people to be in charge of their lives without medication if they don't need it. And the way I decide if somebody needs it, if they have a persisting high PHQ-9 or Kessler and they're not getting better over 3 or 4 weeks, then I would have a discussion about medication. But I would say to people in that situation, look, in my experience, and you're not exercising and you're not seeing your friends and you're not socializing, you start doing those things and, you know, half the people feel better in a couple of weeks. You're going to feel better quicker if you do those things and you take them. So I do a bit of a sales pitch. When I do give an antidepressant, I also give a sales pitch around that. This is probably going to make you feel a lot better. It will take a little bit of time. But I think we have to market and unmarket our things, learning how to get behavior change in patients. So if I think somebody would benefit from an antidepressant, or usually for anxiety, actually more so, and I usually give lowish doses, and I say this will probably make a big difference to you. And of course it does. But you don't know how much of that sales pitch and how much of it's organic chemistry, you know. We never know, basically.
So there may be the odd occasion that we are prescribing, like you say, in your case, 7% in general practice, so it shouldn't be any more than that in an urgent case.
No, I think less than 10% at the first visit. I think it's worth auditing your data and just seeing what's happening. It's quite, I don't know whether you can get college points for that. We can in the College of GPs. And it's actually quite sobering, really. I mean, I thought it would be very lower than that, actually. I was a bit disappointed. But 7% is okay, I think, you know, because there's a lot of people on antidepressants. And there's a lot of people on. The problem with the antidepressants, of course, there's a huge number of people in our communities who are still got a low mood. They're no better from the drugs. But they won't want to stop them because they're worried they're going to feel worse. So that's the downside of putting someone on a drug. They then feel like this is the only thing keeping me from here to oblivion. And
so it's hard to tell them that the exercise and the social interactions they've made is probably what's made you better, than the pill was just along for the ride.
Absolutely. You know, and I think I try and get my colleagues to not give antidepressants before they send patients to me, because by the time they get to me, they've had a week or so, and invariably they're feeling better, and they're saying, oh, well, this pill seems to have helped, but I know statistically that's unlikely. So, and the other thing is, if you keep trying the drugs, once you've tried a second drug, the benefit is about half of what the first one could have got, and then if you do it again, it's about half of what you could have got the next time. So you're going from, you know, a small benefit, a small percentage benefit, up to about 25% in severe depression. That comes down to 12.5% with the second drug, comes down to 6.25% with the third drug. So if you're chasing the neurotransmitter, you end up chasing your tail, basically. So,
and are those numbers the same regardless of which agent you decide to
seems
start with?
To be, yeah. There are not a lot of studies to do that, but the big star D, by the time they got to the third drug, really nothing was happening. Other than placebo, basically. So there's a chunk of people who do seem to benefit from antidepressants. We don't know who they are, but the more severe the depression, and I would say the more severe depression that's persisting, although that's yet to be tested, are the ones who need antidepressants. So that's the advantage of doing a Kessler or a PHQ-9. If the score stays up there, then that's a situation where you might want to have a discussion about medication. And some people don't like medication. So, and some people, actually younger people are probably keener on antidepressants than older people. Some of the literature is starting to say now. They want the quick fix and don't want to make the investment. So that's an interesting, but I think there's no sign other than severity that the antidepressants may work. So a persisting high PHQ-9 would be a situation to at least discuss antidepressants. That's based on FDA data. That's not my opinion. That just comes straight out of the FDA, where there's no publication bias.
So you mentioned brucearoyl.com, the website.
Yep.
We can find the free downloadable
Work Love Play. Yep.
Work Love Play.
Put it in your computers.
What else is available on there? Do you have some of the numbers and that you've mentioned today? Some of
there's my talk on the first consultation with a depressed patient, which I think would be relevant. I'm about to refilm that. There's an 11-minute consultation of me on there. There's a handout I give patients. There's 54 killer narratives. The killer narratives are, I think, epigrams is the term, the technical term. So words like, if your tears were words, what would they be saying? Waiting is costly. Life's all invented anyway, so why not invent something that works for yourself? A lot of people invent a life that doesn't work. So there's lots of interesting little sayings there. Under killer narratives, work, love, play, and various other things that are based on acceptance and commitment therapy. Even one there on how to give a good talk if you're a public speaker, how to give a good talk, which improves our students' presentations enormously, based on TED Talk technology.
And all of that is free.
All of free. Everything on brucearoyl.com is free. Feel free to use it.
We'll put a link in the show notes and encourage people to certainly use that work, love, play form, because you've mentioned the PHQ-9 and Kessler.
Yep.
You would go on and do that after doing one of these in some cases, but this is often enough.
Well, a score below 35, you know the PHQ-9 is going to be above 10 virtually every time. We've validated that. So if you're short of time, what you really want is contextual information. When you start using work, love, play, you might want to do a PHQ-9 as well, but you get to the point where you can guess the score. I can guess the score pretty well within 5 points now. And I'm very rarely wrong, but that's just through experience of using it in the clinic. We've actually got work, love, play in our computer, so we can. I've forgotten what that term is, but we can download it with the patient name on the top, and then we scan work, love, play into the notes, so we don't actually have to write too many notes. So you won't see a lot of notes in my notes. There's the presenting problem, a PHQ-9, a work, love, play scanned. And a few handouts and things that I give patients. There's a handout there I give patients, which I'm about to change, but a lot of patients find that quite useful. They take it home and stick it on their computers and things. So lots of handy stuff there.
Excellent. So hopefully that will give us the confidence to kind of face these consultations without fear of missing the significant pathology. But also provide patients with a little bit of a pep talk, almost something to give them some focus, and also kind of highlight the areas of their life that they can focus
change.
On, and change. And and if we follow some of the information on your website, we can obviously you've got the take home information too. Bruce, thank you for sharing your wisdom. You've obviously done a lot of work in this area, so it's not the easiest branch of medicine, but it's certainly common in urgent care, or common enough in urgent care that we need to have that kind of familiarity that you've that you've got over the years. So, like you say, experience is important. Clinical experience, the more you do, the better you get. But sharing your experience is a leg up in the right direction. So thank you for sharing with us.
Thank you very much for the interview.
Many thanks to Bruce for talking to our podcast. Do make sure you check out brucearoll.com. And also, if you're not familiar with the Goodfellow Unit, make sure you head over there where you can find primary care focused podcasts, e-learning resources and webinars, and you can sign up for the Goodfellow Gems, which Bruce curates. And of course, don't forget you can also find information there on the Goodfellow Symposium, which is on the weekend of March the 28th at the Vodafone Events Centre in Manukau. The Royal New Zealand College of Urgent Care has their usual educational stream, and on the Saturday night we hold our annual general meeting. Now, as always, if you have any comments, questions, suggestions or corrections, email podcast@rnzcuc.org.nz. We'll be back again next week with another podcast. I look forward to seeing you all then, but for now, thanks for listening.